You're listening to American Shadows, a production of iHeartRadio and Grim and Mild from Aaron Mankey.
The rugged New England coastline has seen its fair share of tragedy. The Isle of Shoals, a collection of 9 rocky, treeless islands off the coasts of New Hampshire and Maine, has been cast in the starring role of the human dramas that have played out across the centuries. The name of the islands comes from 2 possible places, from the shallow shoals long used for fishing in these waters, or the schools of fish that swam hardily when Europeans began showing up. And with these colonizers, as it often happens, came new monikers. Each jut of an island became rechristened with names such as Star, White, Cedar, Appledore, and the one where our stories take place today, Smutty Nose. The islands proved to be a lucrative fishing hub in the early 1600s, and by 1645, as many as 600 people were braving their harsh, windswept landscapes. It was a place that required a certain sturdiness of character and temperament, and attracted folks who could play that part. It also attracted pirates. It was said that the lawless islanders were happy to host these seafaring bandits, and legend tells us that not only do their treasures still exist there, but so do their ghosts. Author and resident Celia Thaxter was among the people who wrote of these legends, telling the story of Philip Babb, the island's butcher and a rumored pirate associate, who purportedly was so wicked in life that there was speculation as to whether he could ever rest in death. He supposedly dug a hole in the ground of Appledore Island, where he and a friend found a large treasure chest that stank of sulfur and gave off smoke when they tried to open it. Famed author Nathaniel Hawthorne, who was trying to outrun his family's association with the Salem witch trials just down the coastline, recorded this tale in his journal, attesting that Celia's father had seen this ghost with his own eyes. According to one tale, a shoaler on Appledore was out walking one night when he spotted a man running toward him. He assumed it was a friend trying to scare him, but when the figure got closer, it became clear that it had a corpse's face and sunken eyes. The figure then pulled a wicked-looking knife from his belt and held it high. It looked uncannily like the butcher's knife that Philip was known to have carried with him. The shoaler, of course, ran. Some say that this phantom is guarding a treasure chest. It's also said that Philip was buried somewhere nearby. Could it be Blackbeard's treasure? Some think so. Rumors proliferate around the isle, as each island claims to harbor the treasure itself. Blackbeard supposedly stranded his wife there, though whether it was his 13th, 14th, or 15th is still up for debate. Other pirates, such as Ned Lowe, William Fly, and John Quelch, all passed through here, with some, such as George and Rachel Wall, settling down to stay for a while. Even still, many of the pirate legends that continue to live on here are just that, legends. There's no concrete evidence that Blackbeard even visited the Isle of Shoals. But in one of the darkest hours on the isle, one seafaring man proved to be more fearsome than all legends and hauntings that call the islands home. I'm Lauren Vogelbaum. Welcome to American Shadows. By the 1870s, the Isle of Shoals was experiencing a slow trickle of change. It had long been a fishing hub, but now tourism slowly began replacing tradition. Smutty Nose Island is rumored to have gotten its name from its shape, which supposedly resembled the nose of a fearsome sea creature. It had gained prominence as a workstation for passing ships, featuring a compound that included a dock and warehouse, a distillery and brewery, a boathouse and hotel, a blacksmith shop, and windmill. For fishermen, who largely lived aboard their ships, the island became a welcome reprieve where they could work and play before continuing on, back out into the cold New England waters. If you can imagine a mirage in the distance that could offer you anything you wanted, Smutty Nose felt like that to seaworn sailors, but it didn't disappear when they got close. The fishing industry, though, would be decimated by the American Revolution and the following War of 1812. Still, the island did okay. Eventually, the proprietor of the compound decided to build a 3-story hotel for summer tourists, which he called the Mid-Ocean House of Entertainment. By the late 1800s, wealthy businessmen took a gamble on the islands, buying up huge swaths of land, raising fishing cottages, and building hotels for tourists to rest in. On Smutty Nose Island, only one family remained, the Huntvets and the Christiansens, a close-knit group that shared one red house surrounded by the sea, 6 miles from the rugged New Hampshire coastline. John and Marin had landed on the island first, then sent for Marin's sister, Karen. Karen had found work and lived at the Appledore Hotel. Eventually, John's brother Matthew joined them, and together they tended to their fishing schooner, the Clarabella. Together, the family thrived on their island home, not so much castaways as they were a motley crew of seagoing and seafaring peoples. John was a good fisherman. He was eventually able to invest in trawling equipment, the cutting edge and favored fishing tools of the day, and occasionally was able to hire help aboard his boat. One of those men was a handsome, 6-foot-tall Prussian immigrant named Louis Wagner, a struggling boat hand. John was able to give him a job and also a place to stay for a few months from April through November of 1872. Louis ended up spending a lot of time in the home with Marin due to his rheumatism. It's said that they got along famously and even became as close as siblings. He eventually moved out, most likely to make room for the arrival of Marin and Karen's half-brother Ivan and his wife, Annette. It was hard for Louis to find work in nearby Portsmouth on the mainland. Soon, he was sharing a cheap room in a boarding house with multiple other men. Cash was hard to come by, and rent, as it always seems to, was coming due. As fortune would have it, he ran into his old friends on the Clarabella down at the docks on the night of March 5th of 1873. He asked John several times over the course of their conversation whether they planned on returning home to Smutty Nose that night. It's hard to say now how this made John feel, but he told Louis that yes, that had been the plan, but now they were running behind schedule waiting for a bait shipment, and they were going to dock for the night. This represented the second change of plans for the Clarabella that day. Originally, on their way back from the open ocean, they had planned to stop on Smutty Nose to pick up Karen, who wanted to do some shopping in Portsmouth. She was dressed and waiting for her ride, having collected all of the money for her goods and tucked a little white button in her change purse in the hopes of finding a matching one in town. But the winds had changed, forcing John to bypass Karen and her plans and head straight to port. They had sent word via another boat that they would return to the island around 10 that evening, but now they had no way of telling them about their second delay. John decided to make use of his time on shore and offered Louis a little bit of money to bait trawls when the shipment finally arrived. Louis said he would meet him back at the dock. When the shipment arrived, John went looking for Louis, but he never showed up. He was nowhere to be found. There was a good reason John Huntvet couldn't find Louis Wagner among the wares and weathered boarding houses of the Portsmouth waterfront. It's because he wasn't there. Louis had left John with a plan in mind. Around 8 o'clock that night, he located a small boat along the wharf and got in. He unhitched himself, threaded the oars onto their locks, and began to pull. Louis began to row up the Piscataqua River and out into the open sea, covering the 10 long miles to Smutty Nose Island. It was a clear night with a 3/4 moon hanging high. The 3 lighthouses, all long-cherished beacons of hope and security, illuminated Louis in flashes as he went. And then the light could no longer reach him. He was too far gone. Louis's plan seemed simple. He needed money, and he knew where he could get cash. He knew that John had been saving to buy a new boat, something they had talked about at the docks. And like many on the isle, he knew that John kept his cash at home rather than dealing with banks on the mainland. When he finally landed on the island, he likely intended to burglarize the house without disturbing Marin, Annette, and Karen, who he supposed had gone to bed long before his arrival. He was surely thrilled and unsurprised to find that the front door was unlatched and it popped open easily. he crept into the dark house and slid into the kitchen. The candles had all grown cold, and the stove's embers faded to a whisper. Everything was dark. He noticed that Marin, whose bedroom was off the kitchen, had left her door open. He quietly closed it and jammed the lock. But he was no match for a canine's ears. The family dog, Rinya, heard a noise and began to bark. The barking quickly woke Karen, who was asleep on a cot in the kitchen. She assumed that the men had returned home and in her haze began to speak. Lewis realized he was caught. In a flurry of panic, not knowing what else to do, he picked up a nearby chair and began to beat Karen with it. She screamed and they scuffled, a clock falling from the kitchen shelf. It stopped at 1:07 a.m. Marin bolted upright in bed. She lunged for her door but found it jammed. The latch eventually freed itself as Karen screamed. Shouts of, "John killed me, John killed me," sliced the night's quiet. Marin could only see a tall man silhouetted by the moonlight, holding a chair aloft with both hands. She grabbed Karen, dragged her into the bedroom where Annette was, and slammed the door behind them. Karen leaned against the door, trying to figure out what to do next. And there they were, three women trapped and huddling in their nightclothes. Their only course of action was to try to jump out the window and make a run for it. Karen collapsed from her beating. Marin held her and convinced Annette that she had to try to escape. Annette pushed open the window and climbed out, jumping down the short distance into the fresh snow. But once there, she froze. Their attacker had stopped pounding at the door, and soon Marin heard a new sound. Annette's voice in the yard screaming, "Lewis! Lewis!" The two were now illuminated by the light of the moon, but it was clear as day what was about to happen. He had been identified. This certainly would spell his doom. So he made the decision to retrieve an axe he had seen by the front door. Marin could only watch through the window as Lewis raised the axe and began to strike Annette until she lay dying in the snow. He headed back to the house's front door, now with a weapon in hand. Marin knew her only option was to run as fast and far as she could on their little island and find a place to hide. But try as she might to convince her injured sister to follow her out the small window, Karen couldn't muster the strength. Alone, Marin wrapped her nightshirt around her neck and ran barefoot out into the night. Karen was now alone, save for Lewis. She stumbled out into the house, attempting to hide under her bed. Lewis caught her, though, and strangled her with a white handkerchief. Marin continued her run, searching for a place to hide. She decided to try a small abandoned house near the water. That is, until Rinya appeared. Afraid that the small dog would bark and give them away, she ran past the dilapidated building and to the island's cove. Maybe, she thought, she could find Lewis's boat and escape. But it wasn't there. There were no boats at all. There was nowhere to hide. As she ran, she heard her sister cry out one last time, and then saw a lamp in the house turn on. The abandoned houses were going to be too obvious to hide in. The risk was too high, so she decided to stay hidden among the rocks. It would turn out that Marin was right to choose the spot that she did. Later, bloody footprints would show that Lewis had searched the island for her without success. He checked every room in the closed Mid-Ocean House Hotel, opened every door in the old store and fish house and warehouse. And, it seems, once his search turned up empty, he returned to the house to find the money he'd come for. He also made himself a cup of tea in the process. In all, he came away with a total of $16, roughly $400 in today's money. What he didn't notice, though, as he grabbed the money from Karen's purse, was the presence of a small white button among his handful of coins. The sun rose again, but for Marin, the nightmare continued. She waited until dawn to leave her hiding place, afraid that Lewis was lying in wait for her. When she heard the sound of workmen starting their day a short distance away on Star Island, she began to wave and jump and yell for their help. They noticed her, but did nothing. Marin took off along the seawall, where she would be in sight of Appledore, just a quarter mile across the frigid water. She continued to wave and yell until she got the attention of the children of one Jorga Ingebertsen, who were playing outside in the morning sun. They alerted their dad, and he quickly loaded into his dory across to Marin. He was shocked by what he found. She was frostbitten and bruised, clothing torn and frozen, and the only thing she could say when he asked her what had happened was, "Louis, Louis, Louis." He trundled her into his boat and brought her to his home, where Peeb, his wife, and their neighbor, Celia Thaxter, tended to her. Her condition was so bad they worried she was going to die. Jorga and two other fishermen grabbed weapons and headed back to Smutty Nose, prepared for a fight. At this same moment, John, Matthew, and Ivan were all heading back out again from Portsmouth, their trawls baited and ready for another round of fishing. But as they approached Appledore, people hailed them frantically. Matthew and Ivan hopped into a dory and rowed ashore, where the news was broken to them that Marin had been found near death, nearly paralyzed with fear, and with a horrifying story to tell. Brothers John and Matthew immediately set sail for Smutty Nose. Ivan stayed behind with Marin. When he asked her where his wife, Annette, was, all she could manage to tell him was that she was still at home. He took the dory and rowed over to his island, where John, Matthew, and the three other armed fishermen were standing outside the Huntvent home, which was surrounded by blood-soaked snow. Meanwhile, Louis Wagner had managed to reach the mainland in his stolen boat, abandoning it in a less-traveled waterway in nearby Newcastle. He was icy and sodden, conspicuous as he walked bedraggled along the road back home to Portsmouth. He was fidgeting, angry and nervous, and unable to eat anything when he finally arrived back at his boarding house. He made several strange comments to those who saw him at home that morning, including that he was in trouble and that he was afraid he was going to be taken in. He cleaned out his room and left without paying his overdue rent. By that afternoon, he had spent most of his stolen money on a shave, a haircut, a new set of clothes, and a one-way train ticket to Boston. Once there, he went to a boarding house where he'd once lived and asked the owners if he could stay on credit. By now, the police were already on the case, and they didn't have to look very hard to find him. They apprehended him at this old address, though he quickly denied any involvement in what had happened on Smutty Nose Island. He was taken to jail, and news quickly spread in the papers and through the streets. One newspaper report claimed that as many as 10,000 people poured into the streets of Portsmouth, hoping to enact some mob justice. One headline read, "Fishermen vow vengeance." Another said, "The fishermen at the shoals are terribly excited. Should Wagner fall into their hands while they're in their present temper, he could hardly escape being torn into pieces." John, Matthew, and Ivan, who had lost almost their whole family that night, soon arrived to see Louis in jail. He denied his crime to their faces. John screamed that he ought to be cut to pieces and used as fishing bait. The person who waited to come was Marin. She did, eventually, though she had to be carried in. She was in bad shape, but mustered everything she could to face Louis down. A man who had once been something of a brother had killed her family and tried to kill her too. She knew it, yet he continued to deny it. The betrayal, the horror, was almost too much to bear. On March 12th, it was decided there was enough evidence to charge him with murder, just 3 days after the funerals of Karen and Annette. Throughout his trial in June of 1873, he continued to proclaim innocence. It became a local sensation, and in the public opinion, he was already good and guilty and hanged. Spectators packed to the courtroom from all over New England. It was the biggest event of the year. The crowd hung on the witness's every word. Marin was the unwilling and unfortunate star of the show, reliving the worst night of her life in excruciating detail for the courts. Over 20 people were called to attest to Lewis's actions on the days leading up to the murders. And then there was the physical evidence, the bloody shirt dumped into the boarding house privy, his bloodied and blistered hands, and one small white button in his possession. Lewis's alibi fell short. He denied making any strange statements and attempted to cast suspicion on others, including John himself. He wept that he was falsely accused. On June 24th, he was sentenced to death by hanging. He appeared to take it in stride because he had one more plan. The cell locks in the jail in which he was held had been installed incorrectly. The jailers knew that he could get out, but he promised them that he'd stay in. He broke that promise and took two other prisoners with him that night. His freedom wouldn't last long, though. He was apprehended 3 days later, tired, hungry, and disheveled. He talked about wanting a vacation and continued to deny his crime until he hung the following June. The people of the Shoals, they tried to continue on, but life on Smutty Nose was forever changed. Marin, John, and Matthew immediately left for the safe harbors of Portsmouth. Ivan took up work on Appledore Island before eventually moving back to Norway. As for their little red house, it would never be the same. It was no longer filled with life and family, a holdout of a changing world. By the summer after the murders, with new hotels on nearby islands ramping up business, the murder scene became a tourist attraction. The stories of what happened on Smutty Nose Island eventually evolved from simple news into history and legend. Celia Thaxter, one of the women who comforted Marin in the wake of this tragedy, was a well-known poet with a firm standing in the Isle community. In fact, her family owned Smutty Nose, effectively making her the Hundvet's landlords. In the days after the murders, she wrote a letter to a friend describing everything that Marin had told her. And in May of 1875, just a month before Lewis was hanged, Celia published an article entitled A Memorable Murder in the Atlantic Monthly. A copy was delivered to Lewis in his cell, and he said that Celia was simply telling lies to make money. But really, what Celia did was pen a cornerstone piece in the canon of American true crime writing. Unlike many contemporary newspaper accounts, which delighted in the blood and gore of a crime, Celia wrote about the world of Norwegian immigrants and those who were left behind in the wake of the killings. It was a work of humanity, something that's not often afforded to victims or their families. Her personal letters revealed that she agonized over whether writing about the murders was in poor taste. She intentionally focused on the lives of Karen and Annette, reanimating them as flesh and blood, living and breathing characters, not just inert corpses. The story of these lost lives continues to echo through history. The way that they were written about and remembered continues to shape the media we consume today. Scholars credit her article with being a direct influence on the modern genre of true crime, especially in the case of Truman Capote's In Cold Blood. Karen and Annette might not be household names, but it can be argued that their fingerprints remain. There's more to this story. Stick around after this brief sponsor break to hear all about it. There's a particular literary canon that's existed in American high school classrooms for a long time now. And if you went to school in the States, you've probably read the likes of Catcher in the Rye by J.D. Salinger or To Kill a Mockingbird by Harper Lee. There's another book that continues to set itself apart as a foundational literary text for young minds, The Harrowing Tale of the Lord of the Flies. Published in 1954, it was the debut novel of British author William Golding, who would go on to win a Nobel Prize. It details the story of British schoolboys marooned on a desert island, and what unfolds as they try to establish a system of self-governance. It's chaotic. It's dark. It asks readers to deeply interrogate their own morals. And whether the ending is a happy one, well, it's hard to say. It's a novel, yes, but stories of being marooned on islands can be found the world over, from the long past through the present. And sometimes the truth of these tales provides an outcome that fiction writers could only dream of. On an evening in June of 1965, six boys stole a boat. They intended to go for a joyride. After all, their strict Catholic boarding school in the Kingdom of Tonga left much to be desired in the way of entertainment. The boys, ages 13 to 16, planned to sail 500 miles to Fiji, or, if they were feeling daring and in good spirits by the time they arrived, even further on to New Zealand. Unfortunately, they didn't have much experience in long-haul sailing, nor did they have the supplies they needed to make such a trek. Their packing list was slim, just two sacks of bananas, a few coconuts, and a small gas burner. Notably missing were any maps or compasses. However, they all fell asleep that night. And when they woke up, it was to a storm that sent giant waves crashing over their boat. When they hoisted their only sail, the wind quickly demolished it, and their rudder also broke with the force of the gale. For 8 days, the boys drifted in the South Pacific with no land in sight, attempting to catch fish and rainwater. The boat, which was leaking, barely stayed afloat despite their concerted efforts to bail it out. Finally, they spotted an island roughly 90 miles from where they'd begun. It was Ata, which had been uninhabited since a Peruvian enslaver ship had kidnapped almost all of its peoples in 1862. The boys employed planks to swim ashore, which they reached after an exhausting day of paddling. At first, they dug a shallow cave in the island's cliffs and survived mainly by catching and eating seabirds and their eggs, as well as raw fish and coconut shoots. After several months, they were able to climb up to the long-dormant volcanic crater at the island's center, where people had lived 100 years before. They discovered a pair of rusty knives left behind by Atta's last inhabitants, and with them were able to build a shelter. Not knowing when or if they'd be rescued, the boys set up an island society on Atta that bore no resemblance to William Golding's story. They took turns cooking, tending their garden, and carefully keeping their ever-lit fire. Over time, they were able to construct pens for chickens, as well as a recreational area with a badminton court and weightlifting. One of the boys crafted a guitar from coconuts, driftwood, and salvaged wire. They sang and prayed every morning and evening, and composed songs to sing together. When another boy fell off a cliff and broke his leg, the others splinted it and took over his chores. They would end each day with a council and have a chance to air any grievances before the night was done. And it went this way for many months. In early September of 1966, a fishing boat called the Just David, captained by Australian Peter Warner, was out searching for new crayfishing grounds. When they passed Atta, Warner noticed some unusual burnt patches on the island's verdant cliffs. Above the screams of seabirds, Just David's lookout insisted that he heard a human voice yelling. Warner, who had confirmed with a book on board that the island was uninhabited, was skeptical. But that skepticism evaporated when they saw someone running down a cliff path and diving into the water, shouting all the while. He swam for the boat, and a naked teenager climbed aboard, telling them a harrowing story Warner could barely believe. The rest of the boys came too, telling the tale of their innocent outing gone horribly wrong. Warner was worried that they might be escaped criminals, but when he radioed Tonga with their names, he was met with tears. It was assumed that all of the boys had died. The boys reunited with their families, and the King of Tonga granted Warner fishing rights and permission to start a business on the island. Warner then hired all six boys as crew on his new boat, which was named Atta, after the island they'd spent 15 months on. He figured that if they could live together for all this time, working to support each other and stay alive, they were exactly the kind of people that he probably wanted to work with, too.
American Shadows is hosted by Lauren Vogelbaum. This episode was written by Robin Menneter, researched by Robin Menneter and Cassandra De Alba, and produced by Miranda Hawkins and Trevor Young, with executive producers Aaron Mankey, Alex Williams, and Matt Frederick. To learn more about the show, visit grimandmild.com. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.